Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeira. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as he always does, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
It's time to make the music. It's time to light the lights.
You know, you bring this seriousness to the lyrics of the Muppet Show.
I have a feeling that it requires gravitas.
Yes.
So we're going to talk a little bit today about the technology used to make movies. And we're breaking this up into several podcasts because, as it turns out, there's a lot of tech that goes into making movies. And it would be way too much material to cover in one single podcast unless we just mentioned things and then moved on immediately.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
So we're going to talk about what goes into capturing images and sound. And then projecting them for your entertainment, you lucky people. So let's start off with talking about we're going to talk about both film and digital here, but let's start with film because of course that preceded digital.
Sure.
So film is an interesting thing already. All right. So we're talking about a material that is photoreactive.
Mm-hmm.
When exposed to light. A chemical change occurs and you can capture the light from a particular instant and preserve it on film.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how film cameras work. You have very simply, you've got a lens that focuses light. You have an aperture, which is normally blocked by the shutter.
Mm-hmm.
The shutter keeps light out from the film because, of course, if you had light constantly exposed to the film, it would just the chemical reaction would occur in an uncontrolled fashion.
Right.
So you wouldn't be able to capture the picture that you wanted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
plus you wouldn't be able to control the exposure and
right.
much light gets to it. So it would just be washed out.
Yeah, it'd be this weird washed out blurry picture of nothing,
mm-hmm.
Which could be interesting, but it's not not going to work as a movie.
Right.
At least not unless you're some sort of grad student in – Hollywood who's trying to make some sort of quote statement unquote. So assuming that's not the case, you need to have the shutter there to block light out. When you open the shutter, light comes through the lens, is focused by the lens through the aperture, which is the opening that exists between the lens and the film, and then hits the film, the shutter closes, and the chemical reaction that takes place on the film is what preserves that image.
Right.
So that's how a film camera works in general. Now, a movie film camera is based upon the same premise, with the major difference being that film is fed through the camera at a certain rate, and the shutter opens and closes at a particular frequency so that you take several images all within a second. And when you play those images back at the proper speed, you get the illusion of movement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the whole basis of film right there. Now, the way it works in the olden days with right. film cameras, you had hand cranked cameras.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah. These are the cameras, if you've ever seen footage of old movie sets or even a film where it's set in that era, you see like the guy peering into the camera and he's turning a crank on the side of it as he's shooting a film.
Mm-hmm.
That is physically moving the film past the shutter, which is opening and closing at a specific rate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were a very good film operator, camera operator rather, you could move that at a pretty consistent rate through the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was played back, it would be smooth-ish.
Smooth-ish.
Well, because
nice.
We're human, right?
Well, of course.
We're never going to move it at the specific speed we need. And again, projector speeds are also variable.
Mm-hmm.
So the theater operators might, in fact, in the olden days, this happened a lot. Back in the silent film era, theater operators might set their projectors to play back a little faster than normal,
mm-hmm.
because it meant that you could fit more showings in a single day.
I see.
Your film would be over faster. So anyway, you would hand crank the film. The film goes past the point where the shutter opens and closes, and the images are captured. If you were to crank the film faster, so that you're putting more film through and you're getting more shots of the action, this actually translated into slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
So back in the silent film era, the standard frames per second that you would have for film, and that's another good thing to point out, film is we talk about film in frames.
Mm-hmm.
And you can think of a frame as a single still photograph.
Yes.
Okay? So back in those days, the standard, and I use the term loosely, was 16 frames per second.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sufficient to give you the sense of movement when it was played back at 16 frames per second.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to speed that up, where you take maybe 32 frames per second, but you're playing it back at 16 frames per second, the action would look very slow to you.
Yes.
Actually, look like half speed. Because
mm-hmm.
you're using twice as much film in that time.
Speed.
Yeah, yeah. So you're using twice as much film to capture the same action. And when you play it back at the normal speed, it feels like it's slow motion. Same thing if you were to undercrank. If you were to use less film to capture the action, it would look sped up and jerky. So when you see those old silent films where everyone's suddenly running at a speed that is not humanly possible and everyone's kind of jerking around, that's when they were undercranking the camera.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And eventually they added motors into cameras, which allowed you to create an actual standard speed.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until they found a way of putting sound into film as well in a standardized way that they settled on 24 frames per second, which is the current standard of how many frames per second for film.
Yeah.
Now, you were going to say something, I could tell, and I just interrupted you before you could even start.
Well, no, I was going to point out that TV cameras shoot at 30 frames per second.
Yes.
Which is why TV looks different. It's got that different feel than watching a movie.
Yeah, and it's using video as opposed to film.
Right.
Film.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there are a couple of differences with that. Video is taken in – when we talk about a frame of video, it's not the same thing as a frame of film.
No.
Because with film, like I said, you take the film from a camera – Actually, when you take the film from a camera, it's in its negative format. You have to develop the film before you can look at it as if it were a regular image.
Right. Basically, that's bathing it in some chemicals that will help bring the images out. And then, of course, stopping the reaction and fixing it in place
right
before it can be, you know, preserved for the long haul.
Right, right. And that's another time where you can't have this film exposed to light.
No.
Because then it would ruin the process.
Yes.
It would, but it would continue. It would be as if you were continuing to film on that film.
Yeah, essentially.
And we'll probably get into that a little bit more in our second part of this, where we're talking about post-production. But the other element of video is that a frame of video is not like a single image as it is in film.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Television, at least, if we're not talking about progressive scan TV, we're talking about classic television, mm-hmm. is played where each frame is made up of two fields. Okay?
Right.
Think of your TV as a series of lines of dots. Okay?
Like horizontal?
Horizontal lines. And field number one would be all the odd number lines. So lines
right.
1, 3, 5, 7, et cetera, all the way down. Those would be field one,
right.
And that would be half of a frame. And your television would paint these dots,
mm-hmm.
And it does it at a very, very fast rate. It sounds like it's, you know, like you'd be able to see it, but it's so fast that you can't perceive it.
Right.
But it would paint all the odd lines first, and then it would paint the even lines. That would be the second field, field one and field two. And mm-hmm. together, those two fields would make a frame of video. And your television would be playing that back at, is it 30 or 60? I know that when you're capturing it, it's 30 frames per second, but, so it is a little different. It feels different from film. And,
mm-hmm.
and that translates, over into digital cinema. We'll get into that too.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back to the film, set. So you're limited, originally, with the old cameras, you were pretty limited to static shots. You couldn't really move the camera very much. So if you look at old movies, you'll see a lot of shots that are single take, and it lasts a good long while, and then it'll move to a totally different setting and a new scene, and the point of view won't change very much.
Right, just because of the setups that they had, they didn't have the sophisticated equipment that goes along with, you know, the setting up the shots that we use today, the dollies and all the cranes and all those things.
Right, exactly. Yeah, those and back then you would have a tripod set up,
mm-hmm.
a camera on the tripod, and that was pretty much it. You might be able to do a pan where you turn the camera in a certain direction so that you can follow the action.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, there wasn't much movement. It wasn't until we started seeing things like dollies. And a dolly is essentially a platform that's on wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And the tripod is on the platform. So the camera itself is still stable. It's just on a surface that can move around.
Mm-hmm.
Many dollies, in fact, I would probably say most, tend to be set on tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in turn, also limits the motion that the camera will experience while you're capturing film. This is, in general, a pretty good thing because most filmmakers want to avoid the really jerky motions you would get if you were just holding a camera and trying to capture images.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever, watch any home video ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The home video effect is something that most filmmakers want to avoid unless they're doing something like a documentary or they want to evoke a particular mood. Like, let's say it's a war scene,
mm-hmm.
and you want that chaotic feel where, you know, it's very disorienting and frightening and you're not really sure what's happening. You may want to have a handheld camera effect so that it gives the audience kind of a feeling of disorientation and it helps evoke the mood you were going after.
Yeah, just to point out for all of you amateur home video aficionados, yes, it can be better than that, but most people don't take the time to invest in the equipment and practice shooting as a professional filmmaker might.
Yeah, and there are a lot of...
But you can't do it.
Oh, sure. There are a lot
most
of...
Most people don't.
And there are a lot of home filmmakers who have made their own dollies. They've made their own cranes. They made their own Steadicams. We'll talk about Steadicam in a second.
Yeah, actually, I ran into that in my research, and it's pretty cool. It's not that hard to do, to build, you know, just a basic setup for your own home video equipment.
Yeah, it's very much kind of a jerry-rig kind of approach to it, but really the whole film industry is based off of that sort of ingenuity. You know, we look at the stuff that is used in films today and you think, wow, it's really advanced technology, but all of it is pretty much based on some guy saying, you know what would be really cool if we could get this such and such shot, but how do we do that? And then just coming up with a way of making it work. And really, it's just refining that.
Mother necessity.
Yes, yes. Hey, mama. So, all right. So, we've talked about how film is capturing the light, and you know, you get it, the photochemical reaction on the film. You later develop the film, and you can watch it once you play it back at in a projector.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the difference with digital.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
So to kind of transition from film to digital, let's talk a little bit about video. And we mentioned it already about how it's played back, it's captured and played back at a different speed than film, so it does give you a different feel. And this is actually perceptible. People will say, like, you know, television does not look like movies.
Yeah, that's true.
And even watching a movie on TV doesn't feel like it does when you're watching it in a theater.
Right.
And not just because you're not watching it on a huge screen and you got a $50,000 surround sound system around you or anything like that. It's that the actual quality of the picture and the quality of the movement that you see in the picture is different.
Mm-hmm.
It's because there's a weird conversion process. I'm not going to get into it.
We mentioned it before, though, on the podcast.
The pull down process.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a weird process that you have to go in order to make the frames of film fit the frames of video format. And it's a very strange mathematical process. And it doesn't give you the most natural playback, which is why it doesn't really look the way it should or the way it would if you were seeing it in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Now, video cameras have an interesting setup as opposed to the film cameras. So instead of capturing the image and putting it onto film, it's using something called a charge-coupled device.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's a semiconductor image sensor. And so it's measuring light, and it is taking those measurements, putting it toward photosites,
mm-hmm.
which convert this with an analog to digital converter, convert these measurements of light into ones and zeros.
Okay.
That's where we're getting into the digital. Now, these ones and zeros, that's just digital information that can either be used to capture to put onto magnetic tape.
Mm-hmm.
You actually wouldn't even use the analog to digital in that case. You could just put the measurements of the light directly onto the magnetic tape, use the magnetic tape to play back in something like a VCR, and that would take those measurements and convert them back into light and sound. Or you could do the analog to digital conversion, and then you have a digital image.
Right.
Which you can play back in lots of devices, as it turns out. Things like DVD players, computers, that kind of stuff. The interesting thing about digital versus film, there is a difference in the appearance. Again, you're not capturing necessarily at 24 frames per second, although there are digital cameras out there that can do that. That can capture images at the same rate as film. In fact, the Attack of the Clones was filmed with a camera that could do that.
Yeah, that was the very first major movie, if I'm not mistaken, that used digital filmmaking.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that you might go to this process. You know, you might say, well, hey, why would somebody use, if there's a quality to film that makes it different from shooting it directly to a digital version of the movie, why would you do that? Well, one of the biggest reasons, other than its flexibility, is the cost.
Yeah.
Because there is a huge cost savings.
You don't have to buy film.
Yeah.
For one thing.
That's exactly right.
And film, unlike digital, you know, digital, if something's – actually, there's a lot of reasons why you would do this. But film –
That is one of the bigger ones.
Right, right. Film you can only use once.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So you have to buy way more film than you're actually going to end up using in your movie, because of course, you know, not every take is going to be perfect, and you want to make the best film possible.
Mm-hmm.
Which means you have to do lots and lots and lots of takes to give yourself as many choices as possible in the post-production process, which we'll get into in another podcast. You want to give as many choices as possible once you reach that point so that you don't have to go back and do anything again or do a new scene or anything like that.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a huge cost, buying, you know, 10 times more film easy than you're ever going to need. Actually, 10 times is not even close to how much film some of these movies required in order to bring a 2-hour film to theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And also distribution. If you're distributing a film, that means you have to actually produce. You have to buy more film to produce your movie.
Yeah, right? You have to actually make another print of it.
Yes.
And
yes.
Then ship that to a
physical copy
theater.
Yeah.
And if you have, you know, multiple screens, say for one of the blockbuster films.
Right.
Then you have, say, you know, have your local 24-screen megaplex and 6 of those screens are showing the same blockbuster movie. Then you've got 6 copies for that one theater alone.
Right.
That's expensive.
Yeah, and another really big problem with using film versus digital. Again, film you get that certain quality with it, but
yes.
Digital you can see immediately how well that take came out.
Well, yeah, anybody who has a digital camera, still camera, who has used film in the past is fully aware of the differences of being able to, you know, go back and look at the screen and see what you just shot.
Right.
Versus, well, I'll see this after I get it back from the developer.
Yeah, in 2 or 3 weeks, and then I'll see whether or not that picture actually came out. The immediate feedback to digital is a huge boon to filmmakers. They can see, like, you know, you shoot a scene, you take a look at the scene immediately after you shoot it, and then you decide whether or not you need another take. With film, you all you can go on is what you saw as the take was going. But mm-hmm. You can't really, you know, maybe the camera wasn't aligned properly. Maybe the light wasn't quite right for the film to capture it. But you wouldn't know until you get a chance to look at it later on in dailies. And that, you know, by then you may find out that you have to go back and reshoot a scene that can push your whole production back. So yeah, digital definitely helps during the movie making process to keep things on schedule, assuming you're not someone like Stanley Kubrick who would do 100 takes of a single scene, whether or not it was perfect the first time. That would be immaterial.
Well, you never know. There might be something in the other versions, in one of the other takes. It's, oh, you know, never even intended that, but look at that.
Yeah, another difference between digital and film, which we should mention really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that you're watching a digital movie on some sort of digital playback device, as opposed to, because some digital movies are converted into film,
mm-hmm.
right? You shoot it digitally and then you transfer it to film. In fact, a lot of movies have to be done this way because not every theater has a digital projector.
Yep.
So you have to convert it into film. But assuming that you're watching it from a digital source and, you know, like a digital projector, it's going to look the same way the 100th time it's shown as it did the first time it was shown.
Right. Film. So if you want those little burn marks, you have to put them in there when you're...
Right. Yeah. The little hair that's going across the screen. Yeah. With film degrades over mm-hmm. time and over use. So the 100th time a film is shown, a physical film is shown, is going to look different than the first time because the film's going to have some wear and tear on it.
Sure.
So that's another thing that the filmmakers take into consideration. So the digital process is different. When it goes to these photo sites, the light, when it's hitting the photo sites that then gets converted into ones and zeros.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the digital cameras have something called a beam splitter.
Ah.
Splits the light into component colors.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the component colors of video are red, green, and blue.
Yes.
And we've actually had some listeners write in with a related question asking, why is that considered the primary colors in film? Why red, green, and blue? Because in art class, I learned that the primary colors were red, blue, and yellow.
That's right.
Because red and yellow make orange, and yellow, blue make green, and blue and red make purple, and a whole bunch makes a big mess. And the answer to that is the difference between additive and subtractive colors.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
we've talked about this in the past too.
Yeah.
We got into the cables.
Right. Right. So I'll talk about subtractive colors first, because that's kind of the, you know, you go to elementary school and you learn your primary colors, red, blue, and yellow. You got a little color wheel and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Subtractive. And now it seems kind of counterintuitive, because you think of it as subtractive, but you're adding pigments together to make new colors.
Right.
But in subtractive, you start with white. All right. That's one end of the spectrum.
Right.
And the more colors you add, the closer to black you get.
That's right.
So if you were to add all the different colors together, you would eventually get black.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I do know that if you want to be really technical, you really should say magenta, cyan, and yellow, not red, blue, and yellow.
For print
and for photos and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we're talking about film and we go into red, green, and blue, that's because we're talking about light.
Mm-hmm.
When you're using light, you start with black. Black is the absence of light. So you have no light. If you use different colors of light, say red and green, then you start – if you add those together, that's when you start getting different colors. So instead of it being red, yellow, and blue, it's red, green, and blue. And those are the colors that when you start adding the different colors of light together, you start getting the other colors of the spectrum. If you add all of them together, you get white. So you start with black and you end with white, as opposed to the subtractive method where you start with white and you end with black.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all has to do with the nature of light and color.
Yep. And, you know, anybody really who's messed with their computer settings and started fooling around with the little color settings on your computer when you're, you know, doing some kind of project and you have the different sliders, you probably have an idea of what we're talking about.
Right.
But now I have to confess, I am singing Ludwig von Drake's Spectrum song in my head.
Red, yellow, green, red, blue, 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 red. Can't do that or Disney will sue me.
You kept it under 5 seconds.
Yes. All right. Yeah. Like there's any hard and fast rule to that. So anyway, with a digital camera, a lot of these have beam splitters in them that split mm-hmm. the light into their various component
what
parts,
colors?
The red, the green, and the blue. And then they have dedicated photo sites that record that information, convert it into digital information. All of that together combined makes the picture. The reason for splitting the beam into the component colors is to try and stay as true to the original image as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that what you see in front of you with your own eyes when you're capturing it with your camera is what you would theoretically see when you're playing it back. Because
mm-hmm.
we all know, you know, cameras can alter the way things look to you. Like you can see something that you saw with your own eyes and then you see a picture of it and you think, wow, that looks different than the way I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple different reasons for that. Some of that is because we're human and sometimes our memories are not so accurate. But others is that the cameras can kind of alter the way something looks.
Mm-hmm.
I had another point there with that too. But now I'm going to falter around until I come back up with it.
Do you need a minute?
Yeah. Vamp.
Oh, vamp.
So,
you know, it's funny, not that this is on topic, but, you know, we had meant to cover a whole bunch of other stuff in this podcast, and we are getting very close to time.
Yeah.
So I think this may be how movie cameras work.
Well, no. I'm determined to
get a
little further in it. First of all, Steadicam, because I said that we were going to talk about it.
Okay, because we didn't even touch on the higher definition video cameras or any of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to do one where we'll talk specifically about higher definition video cameras.
That's cool.
The red one is the one you wanted to talk about specifically.
Yeah, but that's fine because, you know, there's plenty more where this came from.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the nice thing is this is we'll have fodder for future episodes. And don't worry, folks, we will space them out so that you won't get exhausted. It's not how movies work after all. So Steadicam was an approach to – remember when I said that, you know, cameras were kind of in a fixed position until they came up with things like dollies and cranes and
mm-hmm.
eventually things like helicopter shots and stuff? It was still kind of hard. You didn't have as much freedom to follow actors as a director might like.
Mm-hmm.
And so that brings us to around 1976. And
1976.
Yeah, that was when Steadicam became an actual like thing.
Oh, okay.
The development of the Steadicam preceded that, and Garrett Brown is the guy who invented it. That was back in the early 70s. He started working on this in 1976. There was the Steadicam brand became official,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
that is a system that consists essentially of a vest, an articulated arm, and a rig that holds the camera. And the rig is essentially a pole with some elements on it. At the top, usually at the top, you have the camera. And at the base, you might have a monitor so that the camera operator can see what the camera is capturing, because it's not going to be at eye level necessarily. Mm-hmm. And a battery to power the monitor. And what it does is it increases the amount of inertia that the camera experiences. Because, you know, a camera's not that heavy, and the tiniest motions can create these jerky reactions. And that's what, you know, most filmmakers want to avoid, because it kind of takes the audience out of the action.
Point of order.
Yeah.
I'd just like to point out, it depends on the camera. Some of those cameras are pretty heavy.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying relatively.
Okay. All
relatively light.
All right.
Compared to, say, a Humvee. Now, which obviously has
African elephant.
A greater amount of inertia involved with a Humvee than it would with a camera.
True.
Or, say, compared to a cameraman. Most cameras are going to be lighter than that. So the Steadicam thing, it creates a bigger axis. It changes the center of gravity for a camera, mm-hmm. and it reduces the jumps and jitters that you would get as you move around with a camera.
It's more or less like a system of shock absorbers.
Yeah.
Because it's giving with the weight of the camera, and so it keeps it steady when all the world is bouncing around it.
Right. As the camera's weight makes it move mm-hmm. downward, the articulated arm actually has some springs in it, like shock absorbers, that act in an opposite upward direction, which means that the camera itself kind of remains semi-level. I mean, there's still going to be some movement, but it's much more smooth than it would be if it were held against the shoulder of a camera operator.
Yes.
So it's a really interesting and useful invention. My favorite Steadicam shot ever is in Goodfellas.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's a 5-minute single take of following a character through a restaurant, and it is absolutely brilliant. Scorsese was a master, as far as I'm concerned, with that shot. That was amazing. but there are a lot of other examples of Steadicam shots as well. So I had to get that in there.
Yeah.
Because I mentioned it before. Also, there's microphones.
Yes.
We were going to mention that.
We were, but I think we're going to have to
to do an episode specifically about microphones and sound on film. That'll be in the future, folks.
Okay.
We're going to wrap this up because, yeah, we're hitting the 30-minute mark now. So this was a good discussion about film and digital video cameras in the filmmaking business. In our next episode, we will be talking about the post-production side of making movies. Mm-hmm. And we might get into a little bit of the sound stuff there. Not too much, probably, because judging how long I talked about movie cameras, it may end up being its own episode.
Yeah,
well, further down the line.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, we're really scratching the surface of it. There's so much technology involved in the production of movies that we could probably do a pretty long series of these.
Yeah, we could probably,
if we really got into it.
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about things like practical effects and digital effects in future episodes. But mm-hmm. yeah, we'll give it a nice rest for a while so you guys can listen to some other podcast topics in the meantime. If you guys have any suggestions for us, or you know, you have a question or comment, something like that, you can write us. Our email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, and Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
If you're a Tech Stuff fan, be sure to check us out on Twitter. TechStuffHSW is our handle, and you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/techstuffhsw.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. And be sure to check out the new TechStuff blog, now on the HowStuffWorks homepage. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.